Good evening. If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Good to have you along with me this evening, along with Neil Heaver, who is our operations director, and he's on the board tonight, and my special guest, and I'm very pleased to have him, the Reverend Shelvis Smith Mather. I'll tell you more about him in a minute. He has a very special ministry in South Sudan. The South Sudanese people come from a rich diversity of ethnic, linguistic, and cultural backgrounds. Christianity and African indigenous religions are the most commonly practiced faiths, followed by Islam. In early 2011, the people of South Sudan voted to separate from the Khartoum-based government of Sudan and form an independent country. And let's just stop right there, Shelvis, and ask why. Why in 2011 did folks want to break away from Sudan and call themselves South Sudan?
There are a number of reasons. Before saying that, I just want to say this, John and Neil, it's such an honor to be here, to be with you all in the studio today, to share a bit of the story of our sisters and brothers in South Sudan, both the challenges as well as the achievements that have been going on. As you said, in 2011, there was independence that came immediately after the referendum in which more than 98% of the people in southern Sudan voted to form a new nation. They voted to form this new nation because of several reasons that are tethered together. Certainly, the reason that many people know about and many people think about are issues dealing with the varying religious traditions and the tension present between the Islamic government that was present in Sudan, as well as the Christians that were there, and tensions between those religious groups. That certainly plays a role in it. However, that does not play kind of the comprehensive role in it. Certainly, ethnic tensions were a part of the challenges that were there. Many people point to issues between people of Arabic descent that were in Sudan, as well as African or Black Sudanese that were present, and what many felt like was discrimination that was shown by human rights violations and crimes against humanity that have been levied against the former president Omar Bashir of Sudan. Others will point to issues such as the oil that was present. I think the easy line that many people say is that the oil existed in the south and the pipes existed in the north, and that was evident in the development in the northern part of Sudan and the lack of development in the southern part of the Sudan, and how the finances from that oil were not evenly distributed, and how many within the southern part of Sudan felt as if their resources were used in a manipulative way, and they did not have access to the benefits of that. Now, of course, there are many challenges, many kind of factors that are part of that, but even those three factors simplifies it. Even when you look to what Southern Sudanese saw as the new Sudan, kind of this possibility of new beginnings, they were split on whether that can be done as one nation in Sudan or if it might be done by them gaining independence. And when they decided to become a new nation in 2011, the differing viewpoints were brought into the new nation, even within the new government that was formed with the president, President Salva Kiir, and the vice president, Dr. Riek Machar. They came in with varying viewpoints as to how the government should be run, in the same way that in the states we would find varying viewpoints. If it was in the Republican Party years ago, there was a Tea Party that came with this emerging perspective on how the Republicans should move forward. Within the Democrats, within recent years, the discussions between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and different viewpoints on how the Democratic Party would move forward in a similar vein as what we've seen in the Republican and Democratic parties here, we found in South Sudan this internal squabble or this internal discussion, however we want to frame it, as to how it moved forward. Unfortunately, in South Sudan, that internal squabble paired with the previous tensions of the former country were carried over into this new nation, which led to the fighting that would happen after it started. But your question was about the war that initially split them. So those are some of the factors that played into it.
Now, that war ended in 2011?
There was a comprehensive peace agreement signed in 2005 with the understanding that after some time, those in the South would have an opportunity to essentially say, have things gone well? We've signed paper. We've put into place some goals that we've set as a nation. Are those sufficient, or is there a need for more? And after the CPA of 2005, and after people in the nation evaluated and reevaluated the progress and or lack of progress within their country, there was that overwhelming majority that said, we need something different.
And that was 2011.
And that was the forming of the world's newest nation, South Sudan, in 2011.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is the Reverend Shelvis Smith Mathers, who has a ministry in South Sudan and has experience also in Kenya and Uganda, correct?
That's correct.
So in that area of Africa. Now, he and his wife, Nancy, let's give a shout out to Nancy right now.
I love you, Nancy. You're amazing. You're wonderful. You're intelligent. You're beautiful. And I'm so thankful I get to be your partner.
And you've known her for so many years because you both go back to Atlanta roots.
That's correct.
You attended high school, college, and seminary together.
Correct.
All right. Were you always in the same class holding hands? This sounds like a really...
We were teenagers with mutual admiration for each other and with great curiosity as to how our lives might be a part of somehow being the transformation in the world that we had hoped, or at least hoped, would happen. And I think that admiration moved towards friendship, and as that friendship moved forward, it moved towards courtship. And the courtship didn't begin until the end of our time in college.
Okay.
And certainly the marriage didn't happen until sometime after.
Well, you have had many years to find out about each other and whether you wanted to make this big move of marriage, and you finally did. So you are graduates of the Westminster Schools in Atlanta, Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, and Emory University's Candler School of Theology. So both of you are reverends. Do you call yourselves pastors? Are both of you pastors?
We are called pastors. I think when officially titled, people would say reverend, and I think many times we would say, you can call us Shelvis, you can call us Nancy.
Correct. Right. Well, so one question now. We started off talking about South Sudan and the fact that you and Nancy work there with folks who are in, many of them, in very dire straits, correct? What drew you to the continent of Africa in the first place?
So, great question. As our mutual, and by our, I mean Nancy and my, our mutual admiration grew, our understandings of how we felt called grew as well. Nancy has always been drawn to, aware of challenges and possibilities in context outside of where she immediately lives. And I certainly have often been aware of the challenges and possibilities in the context in which I'm living right now. So as Atlantans, ATLians, in Atlanta, I certainly was drawn to the challenges of conflict and division in the city of Atlanta. I was serving at a church, New Life Presbyterian Church, while in seminary and after finishing graduate school. My wife was helping to coordinate a refugee ministry in Atlanta, and that came only after she had already lived abroad in parts of South America, working with a couple of ministries. Sisters of Charity of Mother Teresa was one of them. She has always had an eye to what was going on in other places, and that's, while it's beautiful for me to admire, that became hard for me to swallow when we got married, because she was the one that said, well, what do you think about us going abroad for a year? And as she and I like to joke, I said, let's just pray about it. And praying sometimes means let's actually pray about it, but other times it means let's not talk about it, which is what I meant at the time. But we did discuss it more, and we did pray about it more, and we sought wise counsel with people that we respect and admire, and they told us honestly, transparently, and frankly that if you all feel called to work with issues of reconciliation, which both of us felt at that time and continue to feel, they said, one of the best opportunities that you can have is to go and see how other people in other contexts are dealing with those challenges and to learn from them. And the best practices that you see in other places, maybe that can be helpful to the context you know. But at the very least, you grow in your understanding of what it looks like. And certainly for C and I, the context of conflict and the context of tension that we saw in Atlanta in the South, even in our interracial dating and marriage, were issues that surrounded race. And those are unique and important questions to ask. And at the same time, those aren't the only questions to ask. Those aren't the only challenges that we find when we talk about division amongst people. So it was from my wife's, initially her wife's curiosity about places abroad and our together willingness to explore that option that we eventually said, okay, let's go for what will be 1 year. And I'll tell you this, 2 months into it, I was the one going back to my wife saying, well, what do you think about us staying another year? That excitement simply came because I was so amazed, so inspired, so overwhelmed in a good way with the East African sisters and brothers that I had the opportunity to work with, to be able to see the church working outside of the walls of the church in ways that I had seen more meaningful than I had experienced previously and more engaged and practical than I had been a part of. So I was in awe of what individuals were doing to address issues in that part of East Africa.
Now you're comparing East Africa with the United States when you say you were seeing some things in Africa that you hadn't seen here as far as worship services, commitment.
Well, when we initially arrived in East Africa, it was in Kenya, as you mentioned. It was immediately following post-election violence that they had in Kenya, in which there was some political ethnic tension within their own country. That is a pretty stable country. Certainly within East Africa, it's one of the most stable and developed countries within the region, doing very good things, both economically as well as just in development in general. However, after these elections that happened in Kenya, this was more than a decade ago, but there was a lot of ethnic tension that followed it, which was followed by a fair amount of destruction and the loss of lives of about 1,500 people in the aftermath, which is no small number. Right. But what also followed it was a concerted, intentional effort by church leaders in Kenya, Kenyan church leaders, to say, how can we address these issues that are facing our congregations and communities? And they were the ones on the front lines addressing it in the same ways that in the U.S. we saw during the 1960s. It was the church leaders that were on the front lines talking about issues of human rights, injustice, and challenges that were present there. So it was great for me to see in living color the stories that I heard from my parents and my aunts and my uncles who were involved in the civil rights movement, to see that type of energy in a different context on the other side of the world. And while it was dealing with tension, it wasn't white-black tension. This was tension amongst people of one nation who are all African. They're of the same shade, but they're dealing with ethnic division, which also broadened my understanding of how we as humans, whatever our hue, whatever our color, whatever our pigmentation, we find ways to divide ourselves, right?
Correct.
And seeing how that could be multiplied in various ways, whether it's because of ethnic division or cultural or race or religion or whatever it may be, land resources. So that was a broadening of my mind and my understanding about it. So that was a start of us entering into East Africa.
And so Kenya at the beginning, and then was it Uganda after that?
It wasn't. It was Kenya in the beginning. That was kind of the entry point. However, in Kenya, I was working with a faith-based organization called, and it's a long name, Fellowship of Christian Councils and Churches in the Great Lakes and Horn of Africa. It's so long that they just call it FAKLAHA. But even FAKLAHA is a mouthful, FAKLAHA, right? But FAKLAHA worked with church leaders in several countries, in Congo, in Uganda, in Kenya, in Sudan at the time, in many places where there had been challenge. So while I was based in Nairobi, the work was throughout the region. And in a similar way, while my wife was placed with an organization that was doing development work in South Sudan or Southern Sudan at the time, she was based in Nairobi. Because of that placement and because of the roles that we played there in East Africa or in Kenya, my wife would spend 6 weeks at a time in Southern Sudan and would only come back to Kenya for a week or two, and then we'll go back again. So we spent a long period of time, much longer than I would want, being in different countries, and we were looking for possibilities to be in the same country, as a lot of married folks do, to be able to move forward. So that was the entry point into it, and that because I was chasing my wife once again, I was trying to be with my wife once again, the opportunity arose for us to be able to serve in South Sudan, not just for the convenience of living in the same country, but as the opportunity arose, it came up because there was a position to be able to work with an organization dealing with reconciliation and the many issues present in South Sudan that go beyond race or ethnicity, but touch on political issues, religious issues, and many others.
Shelvis, you were born in Atlanta, met your wife, decided that you wanted to do missionary work in Africa. What are you doing in the Lehigh Valley?
great question. So there are a number of churches that have been supported. Both my wife and I are mission co-workers of the Presbyterian Church USA and the Reformed Church in America. And this is not work that can be done alone, nor should it be done alone. It's work that is done in partnership. And that partnership is both with the international partners and for us South Sudanese partners on the ground, as well as these denominations that are made up of congregations. And those congregations that support the work that's going on there, Lord knows we want it to be more than just a pocket to basket kind of relationship. It's one in which it can be mutually transformative for both the congregations in the U.S. as well as the people in South Sudan. And a part of that transformation is making sure we're sharing stories. Both they can hear in South Sudan about people here in the States, and folks in South Sudan can
and we can hear about folks over in Africa.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've come to visit with First Presbyterian Church of Allentown to share a bit of that story, and we're fortunate enough to be able to have the opportunity to come to this great station.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, as Shelvis says, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. We need to take a break right now. Stay with us, and we'll be back with much more information about South Sudan and Reverend Shelvis's work there.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Back with Reverend Shelvis Smith Mathers now. And we want to talk about names a little bit, because there's an interesting situation with Shelvis's children. He has three children. We'll talk about them in a minute. And each of them has, would they call it a Western name and an African name? The Chinese use that. They say, this is your, John is your Western name, and Li Fu is your Chinese name.
I don't know if it would be framed that way. I mean, certainly the names. I don't know if it would be framed that way, but I do think they have names that have significance to our family and our family traditions and the people that we've admired within our family and within and names that are connected to their births.
Okay, well, let's talk about those a little bit. First of all, Shelvis. Okay, I've heard the name Sheldon. I've heard the name Elvis.
Right.
I have not
right.
heard the word Shelvis before.
Right, right, right.
Where does that come from?
Yeah, so so my full name is Shelvis Samuel Smith Mather. And if I work my way back to forward, it becomes it's probably easier for me to tell the story that way. Smith Mather is not the name that I was born with, but Smith was the name that I was born with. My wife had the name Mather. Sometime after being married, we decided to be able to pair our names together. Samuel came straight from my dad. He was a Samuel, I was a Samuel. But that name Shelvis is an odd one. It is an odd one. I've not yet, while I know there are some Shelvises out there, I've not yet come face to face with another one. I think there are some Shells, .. that are in my family. And while my mother never officially told me the story of how that name came to be, I imagine it's a tribute to some of the people that came before me. She jokingly said, I think it was jokingly, that she was a teacher before passing, and she said that she gave extra credit to members of her class to help her come up with a name, and somehow, some way, that name Shelvis came out. So
maybe it was one of her lucky students who won the prize.
There you
huh?
go.
And you
there
came
you
out
go.
To be Shelvis. Well, in 2012, your son Jordan became the first child born in South Sudan to U.S. born presence. Correct? Parents. Correct.
That is correct.
Jordan and his younger sisters Adeline, who was born in 2014, and Nicole in 2016, received South Sudanese names from elders in their community.
Right.
So this is a case that we don't have in the U.S.
Right.
where it's the parents only who name the child.
Right.
So explain to us a little bit how that happened.
So for me to unpack that, I want to step back a little bit more because when Nancy and I arrived in South Sudan, we arrived as two. And certainly there was a lens of suspicion that many of our colleagues who are South Sudanese and East African used to see us. And I think that's a fair lens to look at, given the mixed history of missionary influence, as well as a mixed history of Western and specifically American influence. There certainly have been very, very good things that have come, and I think many of my South Sudanese sisters and brothers will name the ways in which the U.S. and Western presence have been involved, and missionary presences have been involved in positive ways, dealing with the building of schools and medical facilities, as well as development there. That has been helpful. And at the same time, when speaking very honestly, where they could speak about the ways in which Western influence has been at times manipulative. Even the church has used missionary work as a cloak for a kind of colonial influence. And that colonial influence has meant a denigrating of culture for people within countries like South Sudan and other parts of East Africa. So I know that my wife and I walk into that history, both the good and the not so good that are there. And because of that, need to be careful and cautious and intentional about how we engage people, and to be aware of when it's appropriate for us to speak, when they're having internal conversations about issues within their country, and when it's appropriate for us to be quiet. What we realized when we arrived was that that concern meant that there was not an initial open welcome for us, because there was an understanding that whether you're working with a non-government organization, an NGO, or as a missionary coming in, you always have the opportunity to leave. When the going gets really tough, when bombs start coming down and shooting is going on, you have the chance to leave us. And for people who have endured that for years and years and years, it means something if you stay, or it means something if you leave. When we arrived in South Sudan, it was known as the worst place in the world for a woman to have a baby. In fact, the phrase that was used often, it was used, I believe, first by the United Nations on International Women's Day, April 8th, saying that Not only is it the worst place in the world for a woman to have the a baby, but other UN statistics say it was more likely for a woman to die in childbirth than it is for her to graduate from school.
Wow.
That's a significant statistic, and it's not one that any person, South Sudanese or American, should take lightly, nor is it one that we took lightly when we became pregnant in South Sudan. Our intention and our desire was that while we were living there and while we would continue to live in South Sudan, when it was time for us to have our very first child, we would return to the U.S. for the birth of our child. Well, 3 days before the flight and more than 2 months before our child was born, my wife went into labor. And it was quite uncertain as to what would happen. In fact, when we went to the local hospital, and when I say hospital, Dr. Jeff Perry, an American who was starting a hospital, had not yet officially opened a hospital in our town yet. But he and his wife, Elizabeth, and the small staff that they were gathering were trying to open one. They had not yet delivered a premature child that had lived. They had not yet received the equipment that they hoped to have in place. They had not yet built their staff to have multiple doctors or multiple people in different roles. But they were there, and there were an influx of people who were on the grounds who needed help. And amongst those people was my wife. I remember us going to that facility, and for hours we waited to be able to find out, is this labor? Is this not labor? We didn't know. We'd never gone through a pregnancy before, nor had we ever gone through labor before. I remember there was a machine that's supposed to read off these numbers and these charts for you to tell you if you're in labor. And that thing was spitting out paper here and there, and it didn't look like it was working. And when the staff member, Elizabeth, his wife, came in, she confirmed it wasn't working. But as a mother of more than 8 children, she also confirmed, you're in labor.
She knew.
And she explained to us that her husband, Jeff Perry, is working with another patient who's just passed away. He needs to gather himself before coming and dealing with you all. Those are truthful words. Those are hard words to hear when you are, for myself, I'm sitting beside my wife, and all I'm thinking about are those statistics that I know about pregnancies that are there. When Jeff came in, he explained to us that because of where we were in the pregnancy, there was a lot of uncertainty as to what might happen with the birth of the child. There was not clarity as to whether the lungs of the child would be strong enough for this child to survive. There was not clarity as to what condition the child might be in. There was not clarity as to the situation with Nancy because she was bleeding at that time. And his thought was, we need to get you all out of this country. We need to get you to a place where you can get further help. So what he tried to do was to stop the pregnancy, to be able to provide some medicine for her to stop the pregnancy, as well as provide steroids that would help strengthen the lungs of this young baby. But shortly thereafter, we realized that the pregnancy would not stop. The baby was still coming. And with the baby still coming, there was a real concern as to what would happen. Now, this is some of the power of that moment. It just so happened. And if you're a person of faith, maybe you say providentially. If you're not a person of faith, you say it's fortune or good luck. Whatever your perspective may be, we found ourselves in a situation where there was a short-term mission team that was coming from the Midwest. Their goal was to paint an orphanage. However, the leaders of that short-term mission team was a man who had 30 years of experience as a medical doctor working in neonatal intensive care.
Wow.
He was with his wife, who had more than 2 decades of experience working as a nurse with children who've been born prematurely. They came to the hospital when they heard that my wife was in labor, and at that time they doubled the staff. While that was going on, that group had brought in medical equipment that had not yet been used from the U.S. that hopefully would be used by this hospital in the days, weeks, or maybe months to come. But they were pulling it out of the packages. They were plugging it into the walls, saying, we've got to get this working now. And because of the differences in voltage and such, they were pulling it into walls. Things were blowing out. People were pushing buttons. They didn't know what would work or what would not work. And in the midst of this chaos, when our son was born, when he came out, he began to cry, and then he stopped and turned purple. And from the point in which he turned purple and was not able to breathe, Jeff Perry, the doctor who had started the hospital, handed him to Dr. Smith, who was this volunteer who just happened to be in our town at that time, who began working, trying to get our son to breathe. And in that moment, as a first-time parent in a country that is known for its inability to have life come out and be sustained after birth, all we could do was pray and say, God, please help us in this situation. What happened in those moments afterwards was not only was this medical doctor working on our trial, trying to revive him, trying to get him to breathe, but you had these South Sudanese women who heard this American lady screaming in the room, who had come to the hospital for their own challenges, for their own needs. They began to get up and come and pray for us. Some of them, we could understand the language they were speaking in. Others, we could not. But nevertheless, they were coming. They were praying. They were concerned. They were wondering what was going on with this birth, but also for this child. When the child was able to breathe again, what they found was that he was not able to maintain his temperature. He was not able to keep his lungs going, and he had an infection. With all that being said, it just so happened that one of the only incubators around in probably 100-mile radius, they just happened to have it there for us to be able to use. Wow. Not only that, the doctors were able to do a procedure so that they had to do two procedures so that he could be able to receive fluids. And at the same time, they were trying as best they could to be able to help with his breathing.
Now, you witnessed this whole scene that you just described.
We're watching.
You were
uncertain.
In the room.
We were going back and forth at that time, both holding my wife's hand as she is in labor and on the phone with members of the Presbyterian Church USA, the Reformed Church in America, and the insurance company that was working to evacuate us. Our hope was that this would happen in another country, but we're trying to figure through the logistical things as this is happening. And they just so happened to have a handmade, what is the word for it? CPAP device. And by handmade, I mean it was a plastic cup. It looked like bands and straws and waters that was somehow tethered together, fashioned together as something that was connected to my son. I didn't know what it was. I remember asking the nurse what was beside my son in the incubator. She was taking pictures and she said, some months ago, we went to a missionary hospital in Kenya and they taught us how to make these. We've never used it, so I'm taking pictures to show that it's working now. Our son was able to breathe. He was able to maintain his temperature in that incubator that was brought in. It was the boy in the box, right, in the glass box. And because of the work, fast work of the PCUSA and others, there was an airplane that was brought in on a dirt airstrip that carried our son out of Ye with my family to Kenya, where he was in the hospital for the next, I think, 6 weeks, and was able to live. With all that being said, you even asked me why I'm here in Allentown. First Presbyterian Church Allentown, as well as many other Presbyterian Reformed churches in the United States, were praying for us during that time. When we arrived in Kenya, the very congregation that I had served years earlier were there to greet us. You know, when you get evacuated, you don't get to take a bunch of luggage. You get a bag. And you get in that plane and you go. But when we arrived, there was never a point in which we needed clothes, never a point in which we needed food, because it was our Kenya and other East African sisters and brothers that cared for us during that time. And that was blanketed with the prayers that we received here. And because of all of those things that happened, it was the embassy that said, your son is the first American born in this new nation. There probably were other Americans that were born in our town years earlier, but because the nation was new, it was the first time for this new nation. And from that birth came the naming of our son. Jordan came from the name that we found in Scripture, this place. Over and over again in Scripture where God shows up in amazing ways, and particularly when we talk about the journey of the Israelites going into the Promised Land. Many people remember the parting of the Red Sea or the Reed Sea in which they went into the wilderness, but many of us forget that when they left the wilderness and they were going into the Promised Land, what they had before them was a Jordan River, too wide to go around, too deep to go through, and at least as Christian scripture attests to, and that on that day he said, I'll show myself to be the living God. And it wasn't because of the work of any of those leaders, but it was because of God at work opening up the way so that they can go into the place that they had hoped and was promised. It was a Jordan moment. So for us, it was not by anything that we could do that our son would survive. I'm thankful for the care that was there that surrounded our child. At the same time, we know that it possibly could have been a situation in which we lost our child.
Absolutely.
We've lost a child before, but this was a time in which that child was saved. We are grateful for it. And for us, saying this was a Jordan moment for us, in which God worked in miraculous ways for us. We gave him the name Jordan, followed by the name Iman, which is the name of the hospital, Bet Iman, the house of faith, or house of hope.
So his name is Jordan Imam.
Jordan Iman.
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 Okay.
Smith Mather. And, right. But he was also given the name from our elder Yope, which is a very local name, which means the one who comes before his time.
Okay, and he was premature, so that's
very, very premature. Yes. So those are the names that were given to him. His story is much longer than the naming of our other kids, but that certainly was significant in his naming, but even more significant to the work that we were able to do there, because many people, both in South Sudan, as well as our family and friends here, thought, okay, your child barely survived. He's alive now. You had a great run in East Africa. Come on home. And for Nancy and I, we said, no, our work is there in South Sudan. Let's get our child strong enough, and then we're going back. And we felt the difference in our return back to South Sudan. The people of our community, they embraced us. They embraced our child. He is a son of South Sudan. He is a son of Yay.
And how old is Jordan now?
Jordan is about to turn 7. So it was because of our child that we were welcome. And from that point on, we certainly have been part and parcel of the community there in South Sudan, because they've seen us not just as outsiders coming in with this vision, but people who are willing to suffer with us, to be in solidarity with us, so they are now a part of us.
Great story, and what a great ending to it, too, which could have been very, very sad. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is the Reverend Shelvis Smith Mather, who is visiting us from East Africa, in the Lehigh Valley at this point. Time to take a break now. Stay with us, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Nancy and Shelvis Smith Mathers have a son, as you just heard, rather a miraculous recovery with a birth that was premature, and they were in South Sudan, where he was born. In fact, he was the first American.
First American born in South Sudan. The caveat to that is of American-born parents. The embassy didn't have enough data to say if there was a South Sudanese person who became an American citizen, who came back and married someone from South Sudan and then had a baby. But he knew we were two American citizens. We had a baby there. So
there you go.
Yeah.
So that's Jordan. Now, you also had two daughters later on.
They expanded the team from 3 to 4 to 5. Adeline Ann Smith Mather, she was given the name KG by the elders, which is a Kakwa word for home. Adeline is the name. Adeline Ann are the two names given to her from her two grandmothers, who are powerful, amazing women. And then Nicole Christie, was named after our older sisters because of how influential both my sister Nakia and Nancy's sister Kristen have been in our lives. She was given two names, which is quite interesting. One of those names was Pony, the one who follows KG, but then the other one was the name Nepal, which is the name for prayer. She dealt with many challenges when she was born as well, and one of the things that we found out after she was getting medical help in the U.S. was that our friends who our South Sudanese friends that had endured their own tragedies, who had fled to refugee camps, had heard about the challenges our family had faced with our third child, and they together were praying. So when they saw us, they said, the name for your child is prayer, because we've been praying for you. So certainly we are touched by the ways that they've carried our family in prayer and love and hospitality and those things. So those are the names of those three beautiful little kids.
There you go. And shout out to all three of them. And they better be listening right now, too.
Exactly. Don't go to bed. Listen to them.
This once you can go to bed, ladies.
Right, right.
So the daughters were both born in the U.S.
Yes.
Okay. Shelvis and Nancy joined the ministry of Reconcile International in 2011. Created by the New Sudan Council of Churches, Reconcile is a Christian organization that seeks to bring peace and healing to communities broken and hurting from decades of war. Shelvis serves as the principal of Reconcile's three-month Peace Institute, gathers faith and community leaders from around the country, and strengthens their skills in resolving conflicts and recovering from trauma. So resolving conflicts and recovering from trauma, that is really your big task, isn't it?
Right. So to put that in different words, if we can think about place A, place B, place C, and they're different on the map, right, but in the same country, each of these are hotbeds of violence and conflict in which people are enduring human rights violations, each of which have community leaders that are in the forefront of addressing these challenges. Reconcile, often, when invited, by the, whether clans or ethnic groups that are fighting, would come in before the fighting escalates to mediate. Again, this is only when invited, to help kind of help them together resolve those issues. After fighting is done, let's say in place C, if invited, then Reconcile could be a part of reconciling those communities, working together with these South Sudanese. While that work has been helpful and continues to be helpful, Reconcile recognized the need to deal with both A, B, and C, all of these places, and they recognized the need that while these were South Sudanese staff going in, they were also leaving that place. And there was a need to make sure that the capacity is built for the people who remain in place A, place B, and place C. So the Peace Institute, the Reconcile Peace Institute, was created. 90 days that brings together grassroots leaders from every state in South Sudan, so that they can go through more comprehensive training in these particular subjects. And it's not just the theory of how we might work together, the theory of nonviolent strategies from Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., but you're living it out with people from that community that have been destructive to you from your communities. It's not just the theory of counseling survivors of war who were former child soldiers. It's you both learning about the clinical, technical things you need to know, and then going into the local orphanage and working with those young men and young women who were formerly child soldiers. So we try as best as possible to pair the theoretical and the practical. That's what we've been doing the last period of time. Now, because the context that we live in, have lived in, is a one that has exceptional violence, we've experienced that violence, and our town experienced it in a very difficult way in 2016. In 2016, opposition forces surrounded our town, and they started a scorch and burn campaign that led to the destruction of more than 10,000 homes, as well as the torture, rape, and death of many, many people, as well as the fleeing of more than 70% of our town. Like many towns in South Sudan, when people fled from the violence, they fled across the borders into refugee camps, still within the East African community, but they fled to safety. Many of the people fled into Uganda, where now there's more than 10 million South Sudanese refugees working in the camps. So for the last 2 years, my family and I have been living outside of the refugee camps, working in the refugee camps, and with South Sudanese refugees outside of the refugee camps, doing some of these same trainings. And as we did those trainings before with Reconcile staff, we continue to do it each month with Reconcile staff, as well as with some of the people who were trained by Reconcile, our graduates of the Peace Institute, many of which are living in the camps. So together we go in to be able to continue that work.
Who were the perpetrators of the violence in the city when they came and burned and so on? What was their objective? What were they exercised about?
So I don't think we have yet spoken about the major factors that have played into this current civil war in South Sudan. I know that we spoke about the civil war that led to South Sudan gaining its independence, but and I talked about the fact that when the new government of South Sudan was formed, it was a coalition government that had people who were of the same party but had very different viewpoints. Well, those leaders, for example, the president and the vice president, had substantial backing from their ethnic groups. And while there's a huge political dimension to their tension amongst each other, there's also a huge ethnic component. And that ethnic component was seen in that more than 92% of the military in South Sudan was made up of their two ethnic groups. So when the soldiers that supported them were upset about the division between them, they first took it out on each other in the barracks. And then after splitting the army, they took it out on citizens of those other ethnic groups. Mm. Now, while it started with two major factions, over the last several years, other factions have sprung up. Now there are more than 25 different factions that are vying for power in South Sudan. And certainly that's been seen in our town of Yei as well. Both those factions vying for power, as well as the unfortunate mismanagement of the government's armed forces right now in South Sudan, at least in some branches of it. I won't say all of it, but certainly some branches in which there's a strong ethnic influence there. So all of that came together in our town, and you had a number of people fighting for reasons that are still a bit uncertain.
Wow. Shelvis, your ministry over there is obviously very important work in a place that sometimes is dangerous. You yourself have had malaria, correct?
I've had it several times.
Wow. So it brings its problems for you. What's in the future for your effort with Reconcile and with the folks that you work with there?
So while we've been there, there certainly have been challenges. Not only have I dealt with sickness, my wife has dealt with typhoid fever and all sorts of other oddities. And my children have. But while the challenge has been there both for our family and the situation in large there has continuously been the presence, the hopeful presence of South Sudanese who've endured much, much more than I, my wife, or my children have for much longer than either of us have. And they continue to be hopeful as to how they might be able to transform the nation. They continue to be hopeful as to how they might use their skills in ways that might impact their community and their community impact their nation, right? And that's been something that has inspired us along the way. Not only has it inspired the work that we're doing, but also our forward thinking of how this partnership there can be even more impactful. For the last few years, the Presbyterian Church USA, Reformed Church in America, and Reconcile have been working together to do further research on the issues of conflict that have been barriers in reconciliation in South Sudan. That research has the intention of both gaining more insight in the microcosm of South Sudan, but hoping that as we gain greater depth in the situation in South Sudan, that might give other people perspective on the larger scale of their own context. Maybe other countries that have similar issues. Certainly there are many countries in the developing world that unfortunately erupt into war, have difficulty politically, ethnically, and also have a unique presence of the church there in doing peace-building work. So there's been a lot of forward thinking as to how we might be more impactful. Well, within the last 5 months, our conversation, after being stalled many times, as we've spoken with academics and said, how can we pair with academics at educational institutions to work with our practitioners so that we can do further research, after it was rejected again and again and again. And when I say rejected many times, I mean I personally had conversations with, email communication with, made visits to more than 75 academics who said no. I personally sat down with universities, both in the U.S. and other places where this was presented as research, potential research, to be able to explore the role of the church in peace building in South Sudan, that unique role, and it was rejected. And there are many reasons why it could have been rejected. Maybe my proposal wasn't strong enough. Maybe they had interest in the work, but they weren't working specifically in South Sudan. Nevertheless, my South Sudanese partners and I, as well as those organizations, pressed on because we knew this needed to be explored. Thanks be to God that 5 months ago, Oxford University, as well as several academics there, said, this is not only worthwhile, but we want to be a part of it. So as we look to the future, the Social Anthropology Department, or the school of Oxford University, as well as the person that's heading their African Center for Research, have both committed themselves, individuals from both of those, that department and institute, have both committed themselves to work with me as I work with South Sudanese to do further research on this. And the hope is that not only will there be research that gives us greater depth, but Lord willing, it will also provide us the possibilities to gain, to be able to develop more resources, whether it be curriculum that other organizations as well as Reconcile can use to do this work, both in the refugee camps, in the war zones, because we know that while it's helpful for 3 or 4 or 5 people to go and to deal with it in one area and then go to another place, we also realize that's limited. But if we can provide curriculum that can be used on a larger scale, that means more people can be a part of what's going on. Mother Teresa said, we know all too well that what we offer is only a drop in the ocean. But if the drop were not there, the ocean wouldn't be the same. So for us, we realize that the problems are great, the challenges are many, and what we offer is only a small portion of the larger solution. But if we can make ripple effects, praise the Lord. If somehow we can be a part of the transformation in the midst of all of those challenges, then praise the Lord. If we can be a part of transforming even a small part of this bigger disaster, then to God be the glory. So that's the work we're doing. When I leave on a plane in about 2.5 weeks, I'll be leaving to Oxford University with my wife and I. For the next 2 years, we'll be in residence at Oxford University, going back and forth between Oxford and South Sudan. I'll do that research. My wife will continue to lead the Pre-CUSA's Peace and Education Project, and we'll be in partnership with our South Sudanese colleagues trying to move this forward in that very small way.
And what wonderful experiences for your 3 children living in Africa, partly in the U.S., and now it's going to be in England for a while. Mm. Wonderful. Could you, in the few minutes that we have left, tell us a little bit about the 2 young fellows that you mentioned, Jacob and Michael?
You know, sometimes we talk in these broader these broad statistics, and those statistics of 12 to 13 million people living in South Sudan, 1/4 of them being displaced, 2 million of them displaced internally, 2.5 million of them being displaced externally as refugees. Those are significant numbers. It's significant to know that while South Sudan became the newest nation in the world, it also became one of the poorest nations in the world. It also became one of the least educated nations in the world in regards to literacy rates are concerned. While those numbers are helpful to talk about, sometimes it's helpful to put faces and names to it. And when I think about the work that Reconcile has been doing, I think about several people. One is this young lady, Lucy Awate. Lucy Awate came to Reconcile as a young woman who was doing exceptional work, working with children who had been orphaned, children who were dealing with great challenges in their community because of the war, survivors of war. She was already doing exceptional work. She came and was a student at the Reconcile Peace Institute. She did phenomenal work as a student, continued to do phenomenal work afterwards, so much so that she became the first instructor of the Reconcile Peace Institute, who previously was a student. Not only that, she became the first staff member of Reconcile, who previously was a student. As I talk right now, Lucy has been involved with doing trauma healing works, not only with the survivors of the war, but even the governors and other political officials within South Sudan, helping them to address their issues that are there, both the trauma that they've suffered from being a part of the war as perpetrators and survivors of it, but also helping them as they're trying to figure out the way forward. She'll be coming to the U.S. During the month of September as the PCUSA International Peacemaker. It's possible, I don't know. Hopefully that she could come to Allentown. I know she's going to other places to be able to speak about their work. But that's someone who I've admired, my wife has admired. And for the last year and a half, while we've been displaced, I've worked hand in hand with her in what is now the largest refugee camp in Africa, a place called Bidi Bidi, where she previously lived and now is working in to help other people deal with the challenges that she previously
That's had. Lucy. I would love to have her come to our microphones and be on Lehigh Valley Discourse if it's possible. We'll have to leave the stories of Jacob and Michael for another time, unfortunately. Our time is up. It's what happens when you have fun with an interview, and so honored to have you come and talk to us. You have had a jam-packed schedule when you come to the U.S. It's I don't know when you get any rest. Mm. So thank you so much. Shelva Smith Mather, my guest this evening, representing his wife Nancy and their three children. So happy to have you in the Lehigh Valley for a few days. Mm-hmm. Best of luck to you in the future. Bon voyage.
Happy sailing.
With your new venture in England. And look forward to seeing you in the future at
Absolutely.
Some point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in this evening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Neil Heaver has worked the board for us. He's our director of operations here.
Thank you, Neil.
And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.